Lights podcast, Where Native Voices Shine. That's followed by brand new from KEXE, the Season Watch Pod, connecting you with the delights of nature. This is 91.7 KEXE, Grand Rapids, and 90.5 KBXE, Bagley, Bemidji. We are Northern Community Radio, people-powered radio in northern Minnesota, with translator K210 DR in Brainerd, 89.9. You can listen at KEXE.org or on your smart speaker. Thanks for keeping us going. Help us out with your donation. Text the word donate to 218-326-1234. And thank you.
When I think just 15 years ago, looking at Native literature, I could name all the authors, all the big authors of the late 20th century and the early 21st century. Now we're seeing this huge explosion in Native publishing. I want to see Native American literature as a field grow and to really take its place as it should among the great literatures, right, that are studied.
Buju, Anin, welcome to Native Lights, where Indigenous voices shine. I'm your host, Cole Primo.
And I'm your other host, Leah Lem. Migwech for joining us. Native Lights is more than a podcast and radio show. At its core, it's a place for Native folks to tell their stories. Every week, we have captivating conversations with great guests from a bunch of different backgrounds. We're talking community leaders, educators, scholars, healthcare advocates, language warriors, you name it. We talk to them. And we have this great mix of passions and interests. We talk with folks about their gifts and how they share those gifts with their community. And it all centers around the big point of purpose in our lives. And it's another day, another opportunity to amplify Native voices. Hello, Cole. Buju.
Buju, sis. How you doing?
Pretty good. Yeah. Hanging in there. We're now, warming up and, enjoying life. What's new with you?
We're kicking off summer birthday season in our family, of course, starting with me. One more year left in my 30s.
That's right. You had your birthday.
Goodness gracious.
You know, I distinctly remember thinking about that years ago. What I would feel like when you or Bryce turned 40, like knowing that I'm older than both of you, I was like, how could that ever happen?
Here we go.
But here we are.
The countdown has begun.
It's your next ascension, Cole. It's your next like big push into this interesting life. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then we got Marvin coming up here. Got Bryce. Mm-hmm. Got Maria, my wife.
That's right.
And you.
Baby will be turning a year.
And the baby, July 22nd. That's the big one. We're still got to get that birthday party figured out and how we're going to go about that, but we'll see.
That's so fun.
Crazy stuff.
But lots of stuff happening. Lots of years just flying by. I was going to say, we've been at Native Lights for years now. I can't even count the number of years. I know it takes more than one hand to count the number of years we've been doing Native Lights. So
that's crazy.
Yeah. Really excited to kick off today's conversation with Samantha Major. Mm-hmm. Samantha is a direct descendant from Fort Peck. She's Dakota and Assiniboine and is an assistant professor in American Indian Studies at the University of Minnesota. And she focuses on Native American literature, particularly literature by Dakota and Ojibwe writers around the Great Lakes region. Mm-hmm. She teaches some classes in Native American literary studies. That's so exciting to me. Mm-hmm. And what I think is super cool, she's got this project that she's doing, that she's co-creating, called the Ocheti Shakoin Story Map Project, which is creating a digital archive of oral narratives connecting Dakota and Lakota stories across the Ocheti Shakoin diaspora. So I know that's far-reaching and must be just an incredible project, so I'm really excited to talk to her about that. So let's welcome Samantha Major to Native Lights. Buju, Samantha.
Hello. Good to see you. Good to meet you virtually.
Buju, Samantha, we always like to ask as we get started, just how are you doing? How's the family doing?
I'm doing well, and thanks for asking. We're in quite a time. I think we can no longer just keep saying like unprecedented times, but my family's good, I'm good, and that makes things okay, right? My dad and my stepmom are actually up from Oklahoma right now, and so we're doing some visiting around Minneapolis, which is always fun.
What are you kind of geeking out about right now? What's on the top of your mind? You know, what are you thinking about?
Well, you know, if you open the door to talking about books, I'm always happy to do that. I have a lot going on. I'm just about to go to Chicago for 3 weeks and do a little class at the Newberry Library with Dr. Jackie Rand. We're co-teaching Native Studies grad students on the topic of Native land management and rematriation and sort of exploring what does rematriation really mean. This is a word we're using a lot, especially now with land back, but how has this word been theorized and what does it really mean and how does it have teeth in the sense of land back and rematriation and how we see Native women in particular leadership roles. So I'm really excited for that. And so I've been reading in anticipation of that a number of texts, Buffalo Bird Woman's Garden. It really is her testimony narrated through a non-Native early 20th century anthropologist, but her presence really comes strongly through in this piece. And so she's a Hidatsa agriculturalist. I've been loving that. And then on the fiction side of things, as I think about the fall, and I'll be teaching Native American literature, which is my bread and butter and my wheelhouse, I'm currently reading To the Moon and Back by Eliana Ramage, a story about a young Cherokee girl growing up and her aspirations to become an astronaut and go to the moon. Space, sky, land relations, like it all just comes together in these two pieces right now that I'm reading. And I love thinking about those things. So I'm excited and potentially to teach this one alongside some other novels.
You mentioned rematriation, and there's just a lot of words that go along with land back, land return, reclamation, repatriation, which has been used for different like ancestral items coming back. Do you want to dive into rematriation just a little more? I think it's actually pretty fascinating to kind of hear that distinction and perspective when it comes to these conversations.
When we think of repatriation, I mean, this has been a term that's been used part of legalese. You know, it's part of NAGPRA, Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act. It comes from that idea of patrimony, of something going back to its father roots, father lands. And so I think it makes a lot of sense in Native studies and from the Native perspective to be shifting that language to rematriation. And this seems particularly to come up when in connection with land and land return. And the odd thing about it is that this has been, in my view, under-theorized in Native studies. I think we're about to see a lot of theorization about it, a lot of writing that takes up rematriation. But honestly, this is something that really is a term that comes up in Lee Merkel's book, I Am Woman, I think in 1980. It's something we hear a lot, but has not been academically written about as much as one would expect with the way we talk about it. And so the way I'm seeing different organizations talk about it and this sort of budding academic conversation, it is really thinking about the way Native cultures, and again, there's wide differences, but systems of matriarchal power are being better recognized. And we're recognizing that that is the way forward as we move toward land reclamation. Are we just saying rematriation because patriarchy and patriarchal systems are embroiled with capitalism and capitalistic systems and all of this that we're sort of pushing back against? Is it just sort of a counter move in our language, or is there something more deeply rooted there, which is what I suspect and what I think we will find in why we would use this term in particular for thinking about land relations?
You're listening to Native Lights, where Indigenous voices shine. Native Lights is produced by Minnesota Native News and Ampers with support from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Today we're speaking with Samantha Major, a direct descendant of Fort Peck. She's Dakota and Assiniboine, and she's the assistant professor in American Indian Studies at the University of Minnesota, focusing on Native American literature.
Can you tell us a bit about the Native Studies program, the program that you're a part of?
This is my first year back at University of Minnesota. So I was here up until 2019 as a grad student in the English program, getting my doctorate. And then I went and had my first stint as faculty at Marquette University, which is in Milwaukee. And I had this wonderful opportunity to come home. So I grew up in the Minneapolis area. I'm back in Dakota homelands, which is wonderful. And on top of that, I really have the dream job of being part of American Indian Studies at University of Minnesota. We are perhaps the oldest designated American Indian Studies department in the United States. So there's a long legacy there. I'm getting to help build the program out. We just had our first year of our PhD cohort. We have expanded not just to serve undergraduate American Indian Studies degree seekers, but also those at the PhD level. And so we are amplifying and expanding in a time when that is honestly very challenging to do in this particular climate, but we're hanging in there. And it's really important, I think, even though in these institutions, we always have to remind and teach even within our institutions. But I do think the University of Minnesota recognizes our particular position and the responsibilities it holds with its land grant history. You always hear certain places, but particularly University of Minnesota, talk about its land grant designation. When you dig deeply into that history, you realize that it's really a land grab. The history of land grab that really was built on the dispossession of Native lands. And there's a responsibility there that's very particular, and that the programming we're building, we hope, is part of that accountability and that responsibility to think about that history in new and critical ways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you for mentioning that. And can you go through a bit of what you focus on? Please describe your work.
My specialty is Native American literature. And then we get further and further specialized in various ways. In particular, my work looks at the way that Native philosophies around material life or other than human life comes through in our fiction and poetry and Native American fiction and poetry, especially in the Great Lakes region, Ojibwe and Dakota literature. First of all, Dakota and Ojibwe people are very prolific writers, so it's just easy to sort of specialize in this writers who are developing ideas from this particular place. But on top of that, I think a lot about the way that, different in tribally specific ways and then broadly as Native American people, that we disseminate knowledge through story. Story comes in different forms. And today, a lot of times we think of story in these novels that many more of us are accessing digitally rather than in paper. And that's just another form. But I think a lot about the oral tradition of storytelling, but also the way stories were captured in various material forms, paintings on baskets, beadwork on dresses, rock paintings, and even rock placing and mounds across these regions. I find those all to be story forms and part of me thinking about the whole of Native American literature. And so as part of that, I've been part of for about 3 years now, a project that our website might have a different name in the end, but what we've called the Ocheti Chacoin Story Map Project, where we're trying to be really broad in reaching across Ocheti Chacoin, Dakota, Lakota communities here in the U.S. and recording stories connected to place and building a website that is an archive that will hold that, but also thinking about and thinking very deeply about data sovereignty and how we basically do Ocheti Chacoin computing. How do we build this site with Dakota, Lakota values? How do we create the design of the site and how you move through the site in our own way? And so that's been really fun to think about. again, the way that stories move and how they move through different materials, whether it be through computing or through pages or body to body.
Samantha, how far back do these stories go?
Well, so what we did to gather stories is we partnered with folks in their own communities. And so that story recording is going on right now. The other thing is we partnered with some institutions who are sharing their already existing collections of oral histories taken by different story sharers, Dakota Lakota story sharers, and one repository, you know, from Minnesota Historical Society, for instance. I mean, those recordings were done in the 80s, and certainly the stories don't only refer to that time, but go back in memory and shared memory. So really, I mean, some of these stories may be from time immemorial. I think we'll have some of what we call ohunkankan, like the old stories that are maybe more formally considered stories of oral tradition and formative stories in Dakota and Lakota. But we've been very broad in asking for stories connected to place. For example, I met with someone in Crow Creek and he shared stories about playing and teaching lacrosse and bringing lacrosse back and traveling between our communities in Canada and then here in Minnesota and over in South Dakota. And so in that way, we're really open that these do not have to be long-held stories. In fact, we want our stories connected to place that demonstrate our continuance in these places and mobility, as we've always done.
How did you go about collecting these stories, and how did you do it in a way that, you know, is mindful of the communities?
It's a great question. And I would say, first of all, so we're at the tail end of the project. So we've been in the process in these last, I would say, couple of months of looking at, like, how are we landing the plane, you know, and also, like, what went well, what went wrong, or what would we do differently? I think there are some aspects of doing oral history that it is such a huge responsibility, that caring for community. And we did a lot of things right. So some of those things include this part of story gathering, where we really set up a system that would digitally protect these stories while they're in transit from sort of this collecting phase and then into our website phase, which we're insisting will be on a tribally held and owned server, not at the universities that my project partner, Chris Pexa, and I, he's at Harvard, I'm at University of Minnesota now. This is intended for community in the end and to be in the hands of community. In the meantime, as we're collecting these are going under Chris Pexa's sort of digital imprint at Harvard. And we crafted an MOU, a legal document with Harvard that designates that these stories are not for Harvard, not for access outside of our project, and that they will be leaving that repository at the end of this year to be on a tribally held server. We've, of course, crafted a consent form for story sharers and also a story form that will help us as we put them into the website, make those connections. So what are sky stories? Are they designating this a water story, a land story, you know, Standing Rock story or Lower Sioux story? However our story sharers want to guide, that will make the web as far as how you might travel through some stories that are connected. And then the other key piece I already mentioned is that we partnered with people in their own communities to gather stories. So we're relying on that relationality, that these are pre-existing relationships of folks coming in, gifting properly, asking for stories, and that the story sharers retain in their consent form, they retain the rights to all of their stories. And so they can pull them from the site at any time if they want to. They can access them, of course, and designate different levels of access on the site in the end. So lots of layers of trying to be thoughtful. And at the same time, I would say the big challenge is working across 16 Ocheti Shakoin communities, multiple folks doing story gathering, just the monumental support that we wish we could do more of as such a small team, giving suggestions of how to go about asking people for stories, how to set up these interviews, how to follow up. And I think that follow-up piece of reviewing is one thing we didn't think about, and that may be in phase two of, you know, coming back to our story shares, maybe adding with them. For now, it's been a process of initial gathering.
You're inviting the formation of an elders council to help with oversight and final decision-making. Has that been formed yet, or is it something you're still doing? Or
yep, we formed our advisory council before we started gathering stories. And in fact, we are in the ongoing process of the folks we've been able to work with in the advisory have been, I mean, this is the joy of the work I get to do, is connecting with folks who are knowledge keepers and recognizing that, like, these are the real ones, you know, and just getting to visit with them. And then for some of them, and I hope we get to do this with all of them, but recording with them as well, because they have so much rich knowledge to share. But they've really beautifully guided us on all sorts of questions on the ethics, on how to look at these stories. To some degree, us, you know, Chris Pexa and I and our academic team, which is mainly formed of folks who have been recent grad students who are in the midst of graduating or have graduated now in the process of this project, but who are brilliant minds in their own right. You know, we're trying to be very strict about data sovereignty and protection and things like that. And then Delphine Redshirt, you know, said to us, you know, the language protects itself. And it was just genius to hear insights like that, or encouragement that, yes, we want to do our best with being protective, especially in this sort of the data climate we're in, where we have AI, and this has come in the last couple of years of this project, but we didn't know this huge, like, sweeping of eating up of our stories was going to take place, really, or be such a possibility. And so now we're, like, thankful for our protective measures. But at the same time, I think Delphine is right that things that are in the language really have sort of an innate protection in itself. And I believe that. And it was very helpful to hear that.
You're listening to Native Lights, Where Indigenous Voices Shine. Native Lights is produced by Minnesota Native News and AMPRS with support from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Today, we're speaking with Samantha Major, Assistant Professor in American Indian Studies at the University of Minnesota. Samantha is Dakota and Assiniboine and a direct descendant from Fort Peck.
Thanks, Samantha. I would like to take a little step back, if you don't mind, and just, we always want to hear how people got to where they are. What sparked your passion? How did you find yourself on this path?
Well, so I am Dakota and Assiniboine. I'm a Fort Peck descendant. I didn't grow up at Fort Peck, and neither did my dad. And that's sort of the fallout of my grandfather being sent to boarding school at a young age. He was sent from Fort Peck, which is in eastern Montana, all the way out to the Pacific coast to Chamawa boarding school. Out of that, he went into the military and he died very young. So my dad was 5 when he passed. I don't think this is in some ways a very uncommon story for many Native people, is the story of early death, of some level of disconnection through boarding school. But I had the privilege of growing up, you know, I was born actually at Fort Berthold, where I'm not enrolled. I do have cousins there, but I am not Hidatsa or Arikara or Mandan. But I grew up really connected to the Western Dakotas, both North and South Dakota, with grandparents living in those areas. My grandmother in particular, in honor of my grandfather, who had died so young, really guided my sister and I and wanted to give us as much as she could of that part of his culture and our heritage. And so being in the Black Hills, you know, she took us to powwows. She tried to do as much as she could to involve us in community there and give us that foundation. I went to school. I grew up here in the Twin Cities and went to college up at UMD and found myself studying English and sociology. So I was always interdisciplinary. It was interesting because I had, through my English degree, the chance to take Native American literature through the American Indian Studies Department up there. And this is the thing about doing American Indian literature, is in all my years of schooling, which is many, too many, to be honest, I had the opportunity to take Native American literature two times. I mean, otherwise I was specializing in British Romanticism, you know? I mean, like, I read so much British literature because the opportunity isn't there. Our stories are, I think, still within the academy and as a field, marginalized in this way that you just don't have the opportunity to take those things. So when it came to my graduate work, it was a real decision. Do I specialize in British literature, which I've been bombarded with, or do I like do the thing where it's going to take a lot of my own legwork and specialize in Native American literature because it's connected to my background and because it feels important to do? In the end, that is the path I chose. And in the end, it's like a no-brainer. It's such a rich field and it's exploded in the sense of when I think just 15 years ago, looking at Native literature, I could name all the authors, all the big authors of the late 20th century and the early 21st century. Now we're seeing this huge explosion in Native publishing. I want to see Native American literature as a field grow and to really take its place as it should among the great literatures, right, that are studied. But we need to give our students that opportunity.
What continues to fuel you as you do your work?
What continues to fuel me? I mean, there's a lot. So what continues to fuel me? I mean, honestly, I am so inspired, especially when we feel like maybe the world is going wrong or this is a hard time, which it undoubtedly is. Like, working with students really fuels me. And being at University of Minnesota, I have the pleasure of working with more Native students. So it's really interesting how the approach to Native literature can shift when you have a more diverse student population in the classroom, and particularly more Native students who are coming to Native literature and, you know, sort of fall through the trapdoors of the jokes that hit and things that for other readers, it takes some explanation. It's very interesting. And so I would say Native and non-Native students give me life. I really respect this generation. I think they've had a lot of challenges, especially the generation who's in college right now, after what we went through with COVID, all sorts of different struggles. And I find that one thing I've had to shift in my teaching is move from an emphasis on writing to reading, because all of us are struggling to concentrate and struggling to read. And I try and create a space in the classroom and in the semester that allows for a deep reading experience. And this revolutionary idea of embracing joy, embracing something that is my time, my imagination going somewhere, being in a different time or a different place or a different world and claiming that space.
Samantha Major.
That project seems so daunting, but so important. Glad they're doing it in a very mindful way.
I love that when she mentioned that connection between land and sky. In my head, I was like, I think it's us.
It's deep.
You know, in my head, I'm like,
it's real deep.
What if we're that connection between land and sky?
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, the story is the map. I really appreciate that. So chimigwech to Samantha Major, assistant professor in American Indian Studies at the University of Minnesota.
I'm Cole Primo.
And I'm Leah Lem. Miigwech for listening. Gigawabamin.
Gigawabamin.
You're listening to Native Lights, Where Indigenous Voices Shine. Native Lights is produced by Minnesota Native News and AMPRS with support from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.
Did you know that that is the second most observed sound in Minnesota on iNaturalist for the month of June?
No, I did not know that.
I don't know why you would, yeah. But a nerd like me would. That is the sound of the red-eyed vireo, and they are just prolific singers.
Okay.
Number one is the gray tree frog, which we've listened to a little bit on the frog episodes.
Yeah, but you. What does it sound like? Don't you have a mnemonic device for that one?
Yeah, it's okay. So the mnemonic device I have for that one, it's one of the screaming frogs. I think of the toads that do the and then just don't stop for a very, very long time. The gray tree frog does more of a much shorter.
Sure. Interrupted.
Yes. So I think of them as like a 3 second, 3 to 5 second long call. American toad is like longer than 10 seconds generally.
Okay.
So gray tree frog is the first with 108 sound observations in June in Minnesota. A red-eyed vireo is second. The Cope's gray tree frog, which you can distinguish by sound from the gray tree frog, is number third. Can I distinguish the two of them? No, I'm happy if it's a tree frog. The veery is fourth. And then we have the gray catbird, which is the one that tricks people into thinking there's like a little kitten.
Oh, sure.
American robin, sixth. The common yellow throat, which people say it sounds like witchity, witchity, witchity. I think it sounds like, what did you do? What did you do? What did you do? It's a little friend. The green frog, the mnemonic I have for that one is it sounds like it's playing like a badly tuned banjo.
Kermit. Kermit the frog. Kermit the frog. Mm-hmm. You got someone walking in on you? Sorry.
No, there's just, I'm at the library recording today. Okay. And there are people moving. And every time people move, you know, I must look at them.
There
because
we go.
Danger. A human. Song Sparrow is number nine. And they have kind of like a three-part song. And then American Redstart is number 10.
We, just yesterday, I was hearing the hoo-hoo, who cooks for you?
Yeah.
Coming from the island across the lake from us.
Uh-huh.
Just.
Do you remember which owl?
Echoing. Bard.
Very nice.
Lovely, lovely sound. Also, we've been working on our, both Tom and I, working on the dragonflies, the chalk-fronted corporal.
Nice.
That
good.
Is so hard of words to memorize for some reason. I try to think military. Yep. I got to think like teacher chalkboard. Chad Kaditz. Mm-hmm. Chalk.
Mm.
Chad Kaditz in the military. How's that? Hope you're listening, Chad Kaditz.
Chalk. And that's how you remember.
Yep.
Or you just name it like CFC.
Oh,
it sounds kind of like KFC.
Okay.
Yeah, just shorten them.
Sure.
Or give them different names.
Yeah.
And eventually, you know. I have a plant that I can never remember the name of that I've just started calling SpongeBob SquarePants because it's two compound words right next to each other. It's the,
If only people could see the steam coming out of Charlie's ears right now.
I know. It's hurting me. Hold on.
I will say, as you think, this is the Season Watch Pod. I'm Heidi Holton with Charlie Mitchell. Weekly, a podcast, and you hear us on KEXE, and it's about the delights and the curiosities of nature. You got it?
Indeed. I got it. So the SpongeBob SquarePants plant is actually called Catchweed Bedstraw, but it has kind of the same rhythm.
Sure, sure. There you go.
And it's the one that, like, it has very Velcro-y leaves that get stuck to your pants as you're walking through the woods.
Oh, yeah.
Hence, Catchweed. And then it's kind of like lays low on the ground, hence bedstraw. Can I remember the name of it? Clearly, no. I had to just type in bedstraw into my computer to figure out the rest of it. It's the SpongeBob SquarePants.
There we go.
Plant.
Chalk-fronted corporal. Right? Chalk-fronted corporal. Mm-hmm. That's it. Chalk-fronted corporal.
Yep.
Dragonfly?
CFC.
Okay. CFC. Mm-hmm. I did see one. I don't think it was the chalk-fronted corporal. It didn't have the white on there. So I saw just more of a black one, but it was fleeting. It wouldn't stop. I was talking to the dragonfly and it was not stopping for me. It was very busy at work.
Come on, man.
I know. I was trying. So I'm still working on it. So many things, the delights of nature right now. What's it like at your place? What are you seeing, Charlie?
Oh, yeah, it's really good. The hummingbirds at our place have been going nuts. They're going through, we do like 4 cups of nectar into our hummingbird and they go through it every day. By the next morning, it needs to be refilled. I was just mystified because at one point I could see 9 hummingbirds around this feeder that only has 5 holes. So they're all dive bombing and not a single male in sight. And so I was like, is this one female and all of her babies? How many baby hummingbirds does a like one female have? I looked it up. Normally it's between one or two eggs. Well, it's one or two eggs. I doubt many of them lay an egg and a half. And like very rarely they'll lay three. So this is multiple families coming to the feeder.
Oh,
or
wow.
Just like a male that happens to have nine females in its territory. But every time that male shows up, it can barely get a sip in before it's chased off by all these others. So I don't know how many families are coming to the feeder, but it's really fun to see. I have been, that bug net that I have for catching moths has been tempting me how much I want to hold a little hummingbird in my hand.
Oh, boy. I don't think, getting to legalities here.
Yes, we are. And I'm worried that like it would panic and because their little hearts go so fast. I don't want to scare it to death. So I'm not going to. But the self-control it's taking is a lot.
I appreciate that. We too have the hummingbirds. I love, you know, the sound of those. And I'm on the bird feeder duty and they are going through everything so fast. I do not know how these squirrels are walking a tightrope because we have it up high in the tree on a pulley system, right? And, but they somehow they're whipping around, they can do it. So I'm having to fill these a lot because there's so many birds. We put a new one on as Tom is not able to be outside as much, right on the window, and we're getting finches when the bully, the blue jay, doesn't show up, you know?
Okay.
Got some thistle in there for them. That's been a lot of fun. But under that pulley system of a feeder, you know, we have it up high so that we're not tempting the bears. Because Andy Try has said this, you know, and it's his beef with Latimer is taking your bird feeder, which he's doing.
Latimer's feeding the bears, yes.
But one day over the weekend, Charlie, one of the most amazing things happened. Coming from our basement, I heard bear. And I was like, what? Because I haven't heard that in our house, right? And he said it again. And I thought he said pear. So I'm thinking like it's a pair of geese or it's a pair of herons that are out there or something. And he's like, no, bear. And then he's coming up the stairs. It's under that feeder. We're standing up on this. We both stood up on this bench so we could watch it. And it was so cool, so pretty. It wasn't very big. And I actually reached out to Andy Try and told him, like, I see you, man. I see why you're into these bears. This is amazing. And he's like, I said, we saw a tag. And he's like, what color is the tag? And I didn't remember. So I asked Tom. He said it was a yellow tag. And then Andy knew because he's like, I can tell you more about it if you tell me about the tag.
This is Andy Try, the bear guy, who's the DNR bear biologist, just in case our listeners don't know for some reason.
Somehow I am blessed to know people that will tell you things like that, right? So we tell him it's a yellow one, a yellow tag. He says...
Heidi is consulting her phone. I assume that you are just texting with Andy Try, the bear guy, which is...
Emailing, yes. Not
emailing. Okay.
Yeah, I could text him, but I didn't know if that was going to be too much.
I just love that we have a bear guy we can reach out to. The dream.
Also the recipient of this year's Harry Hutchins Conservation Award from the KEXE annual meeting.
I finally got to meet him.
Oh my.
It was lovely.
There's some photos of Andy getting that award. And what a guy.
I learned he is very tall.
Oh boy, is he tall, especially next to someone like me. Okay, so as emails do, they don't come in the right order. He said, we told him it was a yellow tag about the size of a quarter. He said, that's probably a bear that Wildlife Services accidentally trapped. So I write back, accidentally? How does that happen? And he says they were resolving a wolf or coyote situation and he was an accidental catch. Quite the information.
Okay, so does this mean that like there was a paw trap or something that can catch multiple species?
I don't know. But anyway.
I'm very intrigued.
So we're watching this beautiful bear, right? And it is... We're just both just kind of yelling, you know, but also trying to be quiet. We're inside, but somehow we don't want to even bother the bear at all. And it starts to walk off. And this is the part that I could not stop laughing at because it's on a hill, you know, it's kind of steep, but for an animal, they can easily walk down, you know, and Tom has built, you know, steps in the middle of this hill. it walked over to the steps to walk down the steps to the lake.
If there's an easy path, who wouldn't take it?
It was so cool. And then it was about 9:30 at night. So, of course, I had to text my neighbors because it was headed down the lake shore to possibly their places, too. But they were not able to see it. But anyway, that was exciting. I always figured there were bears around us, but I had not seen one before.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
See, that's really interesting to me because you're well within black bear range. Mm-hmm. I am on at least what's understood to be like the southern end of black bear range. But the DNR is now expanding it because they've moved. But we get black bears all the time. And they come to my feeder, which is hanging like right outside our living room window. And of course, they come in late at night when you're well asleep and I'm still up because I'm a night owl.
Right.
And trying to get to our feeder. And every time they get our feeder, they also pull down this pole.
Oh, sure.
And it gets bent and then you have to go buy a new one. And it's a whole thing. And also you're feeding the bears. So the number of times that I have like run outside yelling at this bear that's only 10 feet away from me. And the good thing is they are really scared of humans.
Yeah.
And they always run off. But do I remember from one of those Andy Try conversations whether you can tell the age of a bear by the size of its ears?
Yeah, I wouldn't doubt it, but I can't confirm nor deny that.
Okay. My memory says that bears are born with like the same size ears that they have as adults. So a really little bear is going to have comparatively really big ears.
Oh.
One of the big, chonky adult bears is going to have these little tiny ears.
Sure.
Just a note to confirm what Charlie thought they remembered about bears. Wildlife biologists like the Minnesota DNR's Bear Project leader Andy Try note that ear size is a reliable non-scientific indicator of bear age. Large, prominent ears that stick up relative to a small head indicate a young bear, 1 to 2 years old, while small, widely spaced ears on a large, broad head indicate a mature adult, 5 years or older.
This was about like the height, as I described it to John Latimer, the height of his dog, so a black lab.
Okay. They're always smaller than I think they're going to be, at least down here.
Yeah. And the fur looked just shiny and amazing. And yes. It was so
isn't
fun.
Isn't their fur amazing how well it just absorbs light? Yeah. It's like they're little voids.
Yeah. It was so much fun. Hey, we had so many people, as can be expected, texting in during Tuesday's morning show on KXC that is chock full of nature, including our friend Noah in Brit. He said, good morning from the homestead. Haven't texted in a while. Just been busy with the garden, bears, and beehives. On the topic of turtles, we were talking about some people were sending in photos and telling us, bragging really, that they were saving turtles, mm-hmm. which is good for them. He says, I would agree that I haven't seen as many painted turtles. That was a question that John had. Compared to the last few years. But on the other hand, I was in the Boundary Waters a couple weeks ago, and there was a dozen, probably more, painted turtles all over the place near the campsite, digging and laying eggs. It was amazing. They were crawling everywhere. Had a fawn trot through the clover here about 30 minutes ago, right as he's texting. Bees are buzzing everywhere you look, something amazing waiting to be seen.
Well, that's the truth.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is amazing, like the... There are spots where there are turtles all over, and there are other spots where they're more rare. And if you're there at the right time during the right weather, they will just flood. When I was at turtle camp, I feel like so many of, you know, you'd like make fun of kids who went to band camp as a kid because they'd always tell band camp stories. Sorry.
Well, no, actually mine was worse. It was yearbook camp. So, but keep talking.
Oh, that is very, very Heidi Holton of
you. And it's worse, is it not? Yeah. Okay.
Okay. But to be fair, turtle camp is very, very Charlie Mitchell of me.
Oh,
okay. So mm-hmm. we found our brand and we're sticking to it.
Yep.
When I was at turtle camp, we would be there from end of May to end of June. And every hour from 5 a.m. until like a little bit after sunset, we would go and check this campground for any nesting turtles. And every hour on the hour, at least four of us would just do this transect of this campground to see if there are any nesting turtles. And like during peak laying season, some nights we would get 10 or 12, and some nights it would be 30 within 2 or 3 hours, just because it was raining and the turtles would just storm the beaches.
Wow.
Normandy. It was chaos during those nights.
Couple questions. You were at a yes. turtle camp for about a month. Is that what you're telling me?
Mm-hmm. Every summer.
How old were you?
Oh, this is during grad school.
Oh, good. Okay. I'm imagining like a 9-year-old Charlie gone for a month at a turtle camp. And I was like, wow, that's okay. I get it now.
To be fair, there's not that much of a difference between a 9-year-old Charlie sure. and a 35-year-old Charlie.
Exactly.
But yes.
It seemed very, very specific for a kid camp.
Yes.
But
yes.
Wonderful, nonetheless. We also are getting a lot of people who are texting in. It was our friend from Boston, Liberty is her name. She texted in this week saying, mm-hmm. Boston has a healthy population of white gray squirrels, but they're not albino. They've made the front page of our newspaper as I was trying to find the picture of 5 of them in a tree. I looked over and I saw this little friend. Always makes my day when I see one.
That's awesome. And a white squirrel. There it is.
Yeah. And John,
yeah, gray squirrels are fascinating. Variability in their coat colors.
Well, and John was talking about it's an albino if the eyes are red. But mm-hmm. so people always assume if it's white, it is an albino. But he was like, I don't quite know why. But he goes, then again, gray squirrels are fascinating. They're gray or they're black. And he goes, and they can be white. But then again, gray is black and white. So maybe that makes some sense. Who knows?
Yeah, I'd have to look really closely at a actually gray squirrel pelt to see if it is just a mix of white and black hairs or if they are actually gray hairs.
And you might do that, I think. You've noted that, it seems like.
Well, there's plenty of roadkill gray squirrels for me to observe, so yeah. I'll keep you posted. The wind's Heidi.
It's an exciting time. And of course, we're going to always, since we don't have as many students who are reporting, we really need you to help us out. Tell us about the amazing things that you are seeing. Leave us a voice memo through SpeakPipe. Who are we going to hear from next year, Charlie?
Our friends at the Bell Museum camps. This is a summer camp run through the, watch me remember, North Central Research and Outreach. No, yes, Research and Outreach Center.
NICROC.
Hi, this is Jack. I work with Bell Museum camps. This week, we just held our first camp of the summer. The camp was a biology-themed camp with students from Upward Bound. And we held this camp at the North Central Research Center, so we were also able to explore the bog during this camp. After we explored the bog, the campers were tasked to sketch and journal about what they saw. And here's their report on that excursion.
Hello, my name is Abby. I'm going to 11th grade. And on June 9th, I went to the bog with our Upward Bound group. I saw many different organisms, including mushrooms, pitcher plants, and felt some soft moss. The weather was very sunny with temperatures hitting 80 degrees. So it was pretty hot, but I had a lot of fun.
Hey, my name is Artemis. The other day on June 9th, me and my class went on a bog walk. The bog was very eventful, seeing many different things. Our class saw lots of lady slippers along with lots of moss. The moss had a nice spongy texture along with a cooler temperature. We saw blueberries and blackberries, though unfortunately they weren't ripe. I very much enjoyed the whimsical feel of the bog. I do recommend taking a trip down in your free time.
Hi, my name is Marley from Big Fork. I'm going to be a senior in the upcoming school year. Out on the bog trail, we spotted a bunch of different and unique plants and animals. A couple of plants I have recorded inside my journal are a red-ringed mushroom growing on a fallen tree, our carnivorous pod plant flower, a couple bushes of unripe blueberries, a cotton ball grass. They look like the Lorax trees, but white. I was the first one to spot a lady slipper. And last but not least, I have a dogwood flower. They're little white flowers with a yellow bud in the middle. Thank you for listening to Be Gap about plants.
Hello, my name is Robin. I'm heading into 12th grade and I go to Northland Community School. This past Tuesday, my Upward Bound peers and I took a trip into a bog near the North Central Research Center. It was genuinely one of the best experiences of my life because the diversity of plants was amazing. I saw carnivorous pitcher plants, pink lady slippers, and a ton of moss. The entire floor was nothing but moss. That's all I have to report. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Ryan. I'm from Grand Rapids. I'm going to be a sophomore this upcoming year. And this Tuesday, we went down to the bog on this site. It's pretty cool. We got to see some unique stuff. We got to see some lady slippers, some carnivorous pitcher plants. It was a new sight, I'd say. Got to see some cool mushrooms, fungi. Other than that, it's just pretty cool all about.
Pretty cool all about. I agree. That is a good summary of the bog. Yeah, I love the way that, like, our student phenologists describe things. Like, I pulled out, it's whimsical. The bog is whimsical. One of the students said, thanks for listening to me yap about plants. If that isn't directly from John Latimer's mouth. And then, genuinely, one of the best experiences of my life because of the diversity of plants in the bog. That's amazing.
Yeah.
And one of those students was from Grand Rapids and, like, just met a pitcher plant.
Wow.
You guys are within bog country.
And listen, I have not been to that bog out behind Nick Rock. I don't know why. I used to work in that building. We were right across from Nick Rock when KEXC in the early days.
Yeah, it was just...
Yeah, and it had the bog walk there. But it's something that I got to do. I got to put it on my list. We're talking about that all week as our question of the week about what are the things we should know about in small towns that, you know, aren't just known, you know, if you live in that town. So if someone's driving through, like, hey, stop at the campus. There's a bog walk here at Minnesota North Itasca. And, you know, we want to know about some of those things. Sometimes it's stuff like what's the best parade? Who throws out the best candy? But we'd love for you to tell us about Northern Minnesota or wherever you might be listening from. This is the time of the year where people are getting ready for celebrations as the 4th of July is almost upon us. And we love hearing from you. You could leave a speak pipe too. I think that'd be really cool for someone to do. Leave a voice memo.
Yes, please. Leave us a voice memo. Up next is going to be our friends at Roots and Wings Forest School.
This is the Adventures from Roots and Wings Forest School reporting from Glendale State Park. On June 17th, I saw an egg on a milkweed plant from a butterfly.
I saw a white admiral butterfly on a plant.
I saw a bluish purplish butterfly flying.
I saw bird feathers, and I think the bird died, and then another bird took it up a tree and ate it, and the feathers fell on the ground. The colors were orange and white and black.
I saw a gray squirrel chasing a black squirrel.
I saw a chipmunk on the tree.
I saw an American toad.
On the trail, I saw a spring fetchling flower.
I saw some timothy grass on the trail.
I saw horse tails.
I saw yellow flowers called ragwort.
Thanks for listening. Stay wild.
I'm so happy to have Roots and Wings Forest School back. And I just looked it up. The Explorers program, according to our website, is for ages 6 through 10.
Oh, my God.
So I'm always curious about, because they just sound so much younger than some of our other phonologists.
Even if they are not knowing, because we had heard high school students before that were at with the Bell Museum camp, even if they don't have that level of specificity, they're noticing purplish, bluish, the way that they are like, this is different. This is what I saw. And you could tell everybody was like, wanted to tell us about something different they saw from the person before them. You know,
it's absolutely
it's great.
Just wait until next week. They're noticing some very specific things. Oh. I just got the email from Leona Sitchi, who's the teacher there. And they found something that I only discovered last year. There are these tiny orange aphids that are called oleander aphids. They're bright orange with little black legs that grow, that unless you look really close, I had to get like my little hand lens up to them. They just look like a kind of green lichen almost growing on, not green, an orange lichen growing on the side of a stem. Amazing observations.
Wow.
10 out of 10.
Oh. As always, our guy here reporting, John Latimer, our chief staff phenologist, talking about moths and butterflies this week.
Couple of notes about butterflies and moths. This past week, I saw white admiral. I saw mourning cloaks. I saw monarchs. I saw tiger swallowtails, lots of all of those. And I saw a Cecropia moth. And the Cecropia moth is one of our largest moths. And some of the females of the Cecropia group can have 5 to 7 inch wingspan. That's as big as a bird. The really interesting part about the Cecropia moth is that the body, the wings are brown. They have these startling white and red sort of patterns on them. But the really amazing thing about the Cecropia moth is the body and the legs. And if you look at the body and the legs, you'll see that they're striped red and white and just really astonishingly brilliant and very, very cool to look at. Now, the Cecropia moths are out now, but will be disappearing very soon. They are May and June, and then they're done. They'll lay their eggs, and those eggs will become caterpillars, and those caterpillars will overwinter. And the Cecropia moths will emerge again next spring. The interesting thing about the Cecropia moth is that, as an adult, it has no mouth parts. All of its energy comes from whatever it ate as a caterpillar. When it becomes an adult moth, it has no mouth parts to eat with. It lives for about a week and breeds and lays eggs on maples, cherry, birch, those kinds of trees. And then the caterpillars will munch away until fall, and then they'll make a cocoon, and they will pupate during that winter and come out in the other side as the beautiful Cecropia moth. And finally, monarchs. And I got a text from Dr. Ed up in Big Fork, and he wondered, he had been watching the monarchs, and he noticed that occasionally one monarch butterfly would attack and grab another monarch butterfly, and then they would sort of fight and struggle in the air and then fall to the ground or fall to a branch somewhere. And he wondered who was whom in that fight. And it works out like this. The male monarchs, when they find a female, they will grapple with her. They will fly out and grab her in the air, and they will grapple with her and fall to the ground. And oftentimes they'll chase this female around. And while they're doing this, they're sort of assessing the female's fitness for mating. And once they have established that this female is fit for mating, they will grapple with her and they will fall to the ground. The two will join at the abdomen, and he will pass to her a packet of not only his sperm, but a bunch of nutrients as well. And the bigger his dowry, the stronger it makes the female. And the stronger she is, the better chance of survival she has and her offspring have. So this grappling that you see is a male picking a female after some flight. And then he gives up a great deal. He gives up like 25% of his energy when he mates with her. And that usually results in his not too imminent death, but he dies shortly after that. And she goes on to lay her eggs, and then she dies. So a little story about the monarchs.
I was not expecting monarch butterflies to be martial artists necessarily, but apparently wrestling, very important for a monarch.
I guess. So this has been the Season Watch pod. You hear it every week. One of the exciting things is now coming out on the podcast starting next week, you'll get a full phenology report from John Latimer from our Tuesday morning show. We're excited to tell you that. So we want to thank the folks behind this program this week.
Absolutely. Our red-eyed vireo call was recorded by Larry Servio on June 1st of 2020 in Washington County. Bell Museum campers, of course, sent in their phenology talk back. Roots and Wings Forest School, as always, our friend John Latimer.
Let's take a listen to that red-eyed vireo again.
I always feel like it's asking questions and then answering them again. It's like, hello, how are you? What you doing? How about that?
Support for Season Watch Podcast comes from the Sugar Lake Lodge near Grand Rapids, a Northwoods setting on the shores of Sugar Lake, offering lodge rooms, cabins, and golf villas, with on-site dining, a golf course, and access to the lake, trails, and seasonal outdoor recreation throughout the year. Plan your stay at sugarlakelodge.com.
KEXE has been serving the community of northern Minnesota since 1976. I'm Heidi Holton, and Simon Gretton recently stopped by and told us why he supports.
Thank you for listening to 91.7 KEXE Grand Rapids.